Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You welcome to Radio Islam's Medical File program, brought to you by the Islamic Medical Association of South Africa. I'm Dr. Faisal Suleiman, and this evening we have two wonderful guests to discuss our topic, ADHD. We have a special psychiatrist, Dr. Ismail Mulla, and Fatima Randri, who is a occupational therapist with a special interest in pediatrics. She works on Durban, doing home visits in Durban as well. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Ismail and Fatima.
Wa alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Now, ADHD, probably when I was training, was probably underdiagnosed and underrecognized. And then we went through a stage where if you were a little naughty, I recall when the transition happened post-apartheid or post-92, when many of our previously disadvantaged people started going to private white schools or previously white Model C schools. If you were a little naughty, the teachers, our parents were quite surprised, particularly our Indian parents who went there. A little naughty kid was often, I'm sure Fatima had this experience, if you were in practice then, that a little naughty kid was referred to the OT because you needed an assessment because you are ADHD. I know it caused quite a lot of consternation. And I think pre-ivermectin Ritalin probably caused just as much controversy as does ivermectin now. But Alhamdulillah, it's a topic not without its controversy, but obviously also a lot of, something that worries parents a lot. So perhaps, Vicky, you should start by, Ismail, with yourself, exactly defining what exactly is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of what happened post-94, when many of the disadvantaged kids or those who could not attend started attending Model C schools, that I had lots of patients referred. And the teachers and the schools insisted that the child must be prescribed medication, otherwise do not bring your child to the school. And there's a huge cultural difference in terms of recognizing this kind of behavior, what you call naughtiness. Many parents do tolerate, but some groups do not want children to be active at all, and therefore they need to be quiet and behave themselves. This is a condition that's been known for a long time and has had numerous names given to it. That, starting of, in fact, the ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder diagnosis is an American classification system. Yet the rest of the world uses the International Classification of Diseases, where the diagnosis is hyperkinetic disorder. There is differences in these two classifications, but at the end of the day, the symptoms are almost identical. And there are three aspects to this condition in order what one looks for to make an appropriate diagnosis or referral for further assessment. The core component is an attention deficit part to it. Then there's an impulsivity part, and then there's a hyperactivity part. Now, previously we found that some kids had attention deficit without hyperactivity, but subsequently we find that this one condition in a way, but this condition is actually part of a larger group of what we would call disruptive behavior disorders. And at a mild end of this spectrum condition is what we would call an oppositional defiant disorder. Children who do not follow instructions, they become stubborn and obstinate, and then have temper tantrums. That's the kind of one milder part of the spectrum. Then in the middle part, what we'd look at is the attention deficit disorder part. And then the extreme end is your conduct disorder, your delinquent child who gets into fight, is aggressive, and then later in adolescence is now involved violating rules of society, involvement of the police, substance abuse. So that's the kind of spectrum condition I'd like to address. And then one looks at the attention deficit disorder specifically, then we look for symptoms of inattention. And these could be many, but often the teachers or the parents will complain that the child does not pay attention to schoolwork, make careless mistakes, often does not sort of stay on task to complete the task, will not listen to you when you talk to them directly, will not follow through or fail to finish work, will in the classroom walk about and not pay any attention to an activity that requires sustained attention. Or sometimes will even reluctantly refuse to engage in any mental activity that requires, let's say, sustained attention. Now, when we look at this condition and this particular group of symptoms in inattention, it must be present in more than two or more situations. So it's at home, at school, in the school ground, and often in a clinical setting. Very often in a office environment or a one-to-one, you do not see some of these symptoms at all.
Ismail, you know, that's a very interesting one because clearly cultural, not only differences, but also cultural tolerance, socioeconomic status, education of both the child and the parent play such a vital role. I would imagine you and I, when we grew up, if you were naughty in school, you got a hiding, you went to madrasa, you got another hiding, it sorted out all your naughtiness. But, you know, this is, I mean, at the general practice level, we often see this, and it causes huge concerns, you know, particularly with the parents, and sometimes often, you know, parents, not only the cost, but also the implications of it, as I mentioned, some of the controversies with the medication. So it's not a diagnosis to be lightly made. But at the same time, of course, it's not something, as you mentioned, untreated, some of those larger problems that develop later on in childhood. So perhaps before we, you know, talk, you know, for the benefit of the lay parent listening to us or will listen to us later on when we, you know, these recordings go out, perhaps I can bring Fatima in here and start with the process of very often it is the school teacher who, or perhaps the madrasa teacher who brings it to the attention of the parents and says, right, your child needs assessment. And more often than not, it's not initially the psychiatrist. It may be maybe not even the family practitioner, but referred to a child psychologist or an occupational therapist. So Fatima, perhaps, you know, if you can come in and let's start with that, you know, theoretical example. Now, here's a seven-year-old teacher tells the parents, your child is really something wrong with him, doesn't listen, misbehaves, doesn't follow instructions in class. And the parents, of course, think, but that's not at home. He sits with his TV and he sits on his PlayStation and he's fine, or anything else. And yet they come to you. How do you start the process and how do you then look at what is maybe just what I would have called a little scamp, naughty child versus the test you would do and start to, of course, with the parents, evaluate a child that's been sent to you because he or she is just supposedly ADHD or one of them?
So the first thing we start off with is an interview with the parents, because often you don't notice these symptoms if they happen so often in the home environment, and we're very used to seeing it. So we start off with a very in-detailed interview, and we discuss the different aspects of the child's life. We talk about whether they are meeting their milestones or whether they're able to do self-care tasks by themselves. We ask them to describe each self-care task that they do, and then we also prompt them, for example, like, do they take too long to do it? Do you have to give a lot of guidance when they're doing these activities? How's the quality of these tasks? And then from there, we often get an idea of whether they are actually a naughty child or whether they have trouble with their planning and organization. Then we ask for an assessment with the child. So here we check their gross motor functioning and just their general ability with their gross motor and fine motor skills, as well as various other aspects. And then from there we can do standard, if they are obviously problems that are standing out to us, then we do standardized testing. And if we notice that there's a pattern with their attention concentration being in a deficit or that they are for sexual problems or problems with their gross motor functioning or fine motor functioning, then from here we can do an assessment report and then provide recommendations to see either the pediatrician or a psychologist or an educational psychologist for either a diagnosis or to receive medication. And then once they have been completely assessed by a doctor, then we can start their long-term planning and treatment.
From your perspective, what are the sort of interventions? And of course, we will come to you know, the more specialized care that Ismail would be prescribing, the psychotherapy or the medication, et cetera, you know, later on. But so now you've had this this theoretical 6 or 7 year old that's come to you. You've assessed them and decided, yes, this just isn't you know, age appropriate behavior or what sometimes would have been referred to as a slow learner, et cetera. So you now have this. You mentioned you may on refer, but from your perspective, what are the sort of interventions, you know, a parent would be expecting you to make?
So a lot of it obviously depends on the symptoms that the child is presenting with. But one of the most successful interventions that we do have with children is sensory integration. And then they can also expect behavior modification, environmental modifications. We can use the cognitive behavioral approach and even anger management, group therapy, and therapeutic use of like self-fun activities. So generally, with a child with ADHD, we often focus on 5 key areas that we provide interventions for. And the first one is their organization and planning. So children with ADHD often have a lot of trouble with their time management and organization. So starting tasks, particularly those with like multiple steps, make the child feel very overwhelmed. So inevitably, this leads to them being late to school, forgetting their homework, or poor academic performance. So here, we work with the children to break down the tasks into smaller, more achievable steps, which stops them from feeling very overwhelmed by the task and not knowing where to start. So we use tools like visual information, so charts, post-it notes, color coding, and checklists, which are very helpful for children with ADHD. And this can come in the form of very creative and fun activities that teach the child to focus better, to plan, and to perform these multi-step tasks, not just in their school environment or home, but to use these skills in any environment that they do come into. And then the second thing that we work on is their sensory processing difficulties. So some children are either very hypersensitive to sound, meaning they become very distracted by like the soft hum of a fridge or thunder, which can cause a complete meltdown. And on the other hand, we have children that love loud noises. They love noisy environments, and they need that extra stimulation to keep them going. So here, OTs, we would help to reorganize the child's sensory system so that they can cope with their everyday experiences without the anxiety and distress, and also teach them which interactions and what activities are safe for them to participate in. So we use things like weighted blankets, move and sit cushions, and rhythmic motions and listening exercises to retrain their sensory systems.
But you know what is, of course you mentioned parents and clearly they're crucial to all of this. So what about the role of siblings, especially where you have, you know, maybe 2 or 3 siblings spaced 2 or 3 years apart? Where do they fit in? Of course, Ismail just mentioned that this, you know, from 0 to 10, there's this entire spectrum of different, and the combination of whether it's inattentiveness, the hyperactivity, or the impulsivity, or the reactive natures, etc. So clearly, there's not one fit size all. But in this spectrum of, let's say, between sort of a 3 and a 7, we leave out, the 8, 9s, and 10s for later. The sort of 3 and 7s, how does the family environment and other siblings come into helping? Because clearly it's a very challenging thing to get all of the siblings, et cetera, involved. But how do you guys work with that?
So siblings play a very important part in the home environment and definitely in therapy. So often the siblings will model the behaviors that are expected, that's more appropriate to what's inappropriate. So how we interact with the siblings as well will teach the child what behaviors are expected of them. So often we do ask if the child has siblings and then what type of behavior or what type of activities the siblings and the child that comes to treatment participate in. And then we like to use the siblings to model those behaviors for the child.
Okay. Well, excellent. Thank you so much. Ismail, if I can, maybe now that we mentioned siblings, perhaps we can just talk about a little bit about the ADHD. First of all, is there any genetic component to it? Does it run in families? Is there a likelihood that if one sibling has ADHD, there's a greater likelihood that others will have it too?
Yes, there is, from a diagnostic point of view, when we get a family history, that helps to strengthen the diagnosis. And it generally, more boys get affected than girls. Therefore, if you get a father who's had a family history, or maybe a paternal uncle, so the males in the family, and therefore sometimes you can have more than one sibling. Now you can understand, even if there isn't just one child in three in the family that has it, that's quite disruptive to the whole family homeostasis, because the parents have to now focus on this, let's say, identified patient, and this child being difficult in so many ways that has an emotional impact on the siblings. So it's not an easy condition to deal with, and quite often we find mothers whose mental health has already been compromised, quite often, as you know, the postpartum depression kind of situation, which is missed and forgotten and undiagnosed. So you've got a mother who's already emotionally challenged, and then a father who may be, let's say, partially absent or not present. And therefore, our focus often in management as well has to be on parent management, parent counseling. But we don't get trained to be parents. Therefore, without the support of extended family, this has a tremendous impact on the family one way or the other, whether the child siblings have ADHD or they are prone to develop emotional problems as a result of one child being so disruptive to the whole family homeostasis.
Ismail, you mentioned, the greater propensity with males. And of course, Fatima mentioned learned behavior. Do you find often that even if, other sibling or within families, the behavior of one, especially when undiagnosed and taking on the more severe forms later into sort of teenage life, has an impact on the development or even the appropriate behavior of other siblings? Of course, you mentioned what the attention or the lack of attention for other siblings can do and the rivalry that can develop from that. But because the reason I ask is we often see it in that even if one hasn't been diagnosed, often seen another sibling just for attention start to behave inappropriately just as a cry out for help or attention.
Absolutely. This is the whole thing, that quite often siblings are forgotten by parents. Because they spend so much of time with this child, going to different therapies and assessments and whatever, and these children to an extent do feel neglected. But at the same time, this particular child with ADHD can stress the marriage to such an extent that the parents are often quarreling, and that has the emotional aspect to also the siblings who are undiagnosed or who do not have symptoms, but who start now showing symptoms of anxiety or depression, fearing that the parents may even separate. So it's not a sort of an easy condition to treat. And I think from the assessment point of view, what I maybe just forgot to mention was that it's not a one clinician who's involved. It's a multidisciplinary team, each one targeting their particular skills and developing a management plan, and therefore in the therapeutic regime it's also the multidisciplinary team involved, what we would call multimodal therapy. So your doctor, your pediatrician, your neurologist, your educational psychologist, your occupational therapist, your speech and language therapist, all of these, and the educator, all the special education set up, all involved in the management of this particular child.
It's about coming back to, no, absolutely. And sometimes, I know, as family practitioners, we try and coordinate sometimes between some of the different specialists involved. And because sometimes there's lack of communication even within us. And it's you're right. It is not only cost-wise, but quite a difficult condition in its more severe forms for the entire family and sometimes even an extended family. Coming back to our seven-year-old, who's now been sent to the occupational therapist or the clinical psychologist, they've done. You've mentioned, of course, the need for referral sometimes to exclude organic pathology. So the reason I bring all this up, sometimes parents would come and say, "But why are they sending me so much tests? They just want you to make money, or one doctor servicing another of his friends or whatever." Because you offered here this, but of course it's important to also rule out organic pathology and therefore the need for some blood tests and sometimes even some CAT scan or MRI scans. Am I correct?
Sure. I think, you know, I think one needs to sort of, well, often it requires explanation. And, yeah, the reality is that private medical practice is expensive and all these tests are also expensive. So at the end of the day, because it's a child and it's a growing child, so if you miss something, let's say, for instance, a convulsive disorder, an epilepsy in the seven-year-old, I mean, it's going to catch up with you at the age of 12, 13, where this child is not progressing. So, you know, it's best that you do a thorough, proper assessment so that, you know, you rule out some of these things and then sort of know then to the parent that this is the direction we're going. Because the long-term implications of these conditions are quite severe. And unfortunate reality is that we get to see these young kids when it's late, meaning that there's a crisis in the school, either the child has acted out aggressively and punched the child, and therefore there's a potential for suspension and expulsion. And there's this 12-year-old which comes to you, and you ask, what has happened over the last 5-6 years? And unfortunately, nothing was done. And there are all these clues and symptoms that this child was showing in the primary school level and was not picked up or parents ignored it, etc.
And maybe something to clarify for parents as well. Often if a parent or if a child has anorexia or bedwetting, sometimes even poor control of stool or stooling in the underpants, is that necessarily a sign of ADHD, and how do we go about assessing? I'm bringing it up because, you know, these are common things one would see in family practice, and of course parents, you know, clearly very anxious about these things and then sometimes get called pillar to post. So a very common presentation, 7-8-year-old or even 10-12-year-old, either just bedwetting or even stool control problems or, you know, stubbornly not doing it, and I use the word stubbornly, advisedly. How do we go about assessing a child like that or for the parent?
I think one needs to separate the two. The enuresis, the bedwetting, generally what you call, there's a genetic part to that, and generally a child should have sort of bladder control by the age of 4 or 5 years. But I get very worried when a child who's soiling themselves come, because there's two parts to it. One is a kind of a constipation where the child holds the stool, and you must have seen where these kids sort of have been constipated for 2 weeks or so and getting to the A&E and having manual removal, etc. And you get overflow incontinence, or you get sort of a running tummy or wetting themselves. But it gets worse, where the child then starts hiding the underpants, the soiled pants, or they have soiled themselves and they can't smell it, but everyone else can smell it. And to me, endometriosis is a severe reflection of family pathology, that there is problems in the marital home and there's a lack of control. Because you ask your child, this child has now lost bodily control. If your environment isn't controlling you, you can't control your own body, and therefore you lose control and you soil yourself. So it's something very, very worrying. And unfortunately, with the constipation part, quite often our colleagues will just give some laxative to make the bowel work, and that doesn't solve the problem. It gets worse. So the emotional aspect has to be addressed. And quite often when you see these kids, they are very angry children. It's a way of what we call passive aggression. It's getting back at someone. And therefore, can you imagine this 8-year-old who soiled themselves sitting right next to you? They can't smell it, but it's offensive to you. Now, what better way of getting back at somebody?
Yes, absolutely. But coming back to our 7 or 8-year-old has seen Fatima. Fatima has diagnosed that clearly there is problem. She's run all her tests, brought in the psychologist. They've done all the counseling. They've done behavior modification, etc. And eventually, you still have this. You mentioned, you know, the aggressive behavior, maybe a fight at school, or the use of language, or something that triggers an event. And now an 8, 10, 9, 12-year-old prepubertal teen, or even a young teenager is brought to you now with a bit of a history of this aggression, or just not coping, you know, failing in school. How do you, because clearly there's still a bit of a stigma when a child goes to a psychiatrist, and how do you, from your end, start managing this?
As I mentioned, from the assessment point of view, quite often when we get to see kids late in the early teens, there are coexisting or comorbid conditions. It's sort of relatively rare sometimes to see just a child, provided it's early, you may get it, you know, the 5-year-old with just pure attention deficit hyperactivity. But quite often you've got comorbid conditions like an anxiety, depression part. There's a close connection between ADHD and ASD, autism spectrum disorder, that on its own is a condition on its own, but, you know, they often coexist. Then you've got sort of speech and language problems. You've got sort of specific learning problems. So it's multiple pathology that we are dealing with which needs to be addressed. So from the medical management point of view, one may use, let's say, start off with medication, and medication has been the mainstay. That without medication, quite often the other members of the multidisciplinary team can do very little. And the first line medication have been stimulant medication and the well known methylphenidate, the medical name everybody knows is Ritalin. It's not a medication that we just had to last 5-10 years. It's had it for a long time. In fact, the sister stimulant was amphetamine, which was discovered in 1934. So you can imagine, though it's banned in this country now, but amphetamine was used previously. It's available overseas in the United Kingdom, in America, in Canada. So methylphenidate remains our mainstay. And when I see this child and the two parents, my first line is, I mean, obviously they've done some of their homework because Dr. Google knows everything. So they come with quite a negative approach. And I said, listen, there's two schools of thought. You may have seen the one side, which is all negative, but there's also another side which tells you that this is the best medication around for children. And that's what's exactly going to happen to your child, that if I prescribe this medication for you, within a few days, you're going to phone and either tell me the best medication, thank you very much for helping us, or you'll be cursing me. So it's a trial. And we've got to give it a trial to know whether your child is a responder. If your child does not respond, then we go to other medications which also have been used for this condition. And I think parents with sufficient psychoeducation, information about the medication, looking at the benefits, looking at the side effects, they're prepared to do the trial because they are quite often, as you can see, coming in a crisis and they're desperate. Please do something. So we sort of engage that, but like with the comorbid conditions, you have to end up adding some other medications to the management plan as well.
Adima, you know, sometimes we just take for granted, you know, that this is what children do. They play, they today it's a lot of it is on the mobile phone or on television, etc. But perhaps from your perspective, what is the occupation of children and how, you know, sort of these challenges, how do they present in the daily life of a child?
So the main occupation for children is just to play, to learn, and to grow. So, so as children get older, they gradually gain more independence through the skills that they learn and, like, feeding themselves, dressing, using the bathroom, or even playing with other children. And eventually they start attending state school or school, and then a whole new set of skills are needed for them to excel. But at this point, or even a bit earlier on, parents notice that they're not meeting their milestones, that they're not developing this independence, or they're having difficulty doing age-appropriate things. And sometimes it's because they forget to do it, so they listen to an instruction, and then they go to do it, but they've forgotten what they needed to do, or they become distracted, or they take really, really long. So if you in the morning tell them, okay, you need to get ready for school and then come to have breakfast, you'll notice half an hour later that either sitting on their bed or they're not doing anything properly, and you need to be there to supervise. So at this point, we notice that their behaviors are affecting the daily functioning of the child. So here with occupational therapy, we work with their sensory, motor, and perceptual systems of their bodies, and we use age-appropriate activities and fun activities to help improve the child's daily functioning, like doing their self-care tasks, focusing on learning, playing in a healthy manner, and also communicating better with their family and friends.
I think maybe we just need to expand on some of them, because we mentioned that often it's the teacher or perhaps the Molana or somebody else that brings these things to the attention of the parent. But in circumstances where, you know, especially often the public schools, 30, 40 in some schools, children in a class, etc., these aren't picked up. And you know, you mentioned some examples, and maybe we need to, I just would like you to expand on some of them. For the parent at home who's seeing, well, the teacher really hasn't said anything, but this poor grades, you mentioned, you know, taking long to come, in some things, not coping, perhaps even in terms of age-appropriate conversation, etc. What are sort of hints or simple things parents can look at, you know, at a 7-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, even though it may not be, Ismail mentioned sometimes the signs are there, they just haven't been recognized. So for a lay parent at home who's concerned, are there some simple things you could do or look out for that would raise awareness or some red flag?
So you can look at, okay, when you are communicating with the child, do they often zone out while you're communicating with them? Do they have poor memory of the conversations that you have? So if you just spoke about something now, within 5 or 10 minutes, they've forgotten what you've discussed. When you're giving them simple instructions at home, like clean the table or go and get dressed, they forgot about the instruction, and they pay very little attention to detail. So in games that have rules or even schoolwork, they rush through the schoolwork and they make a lot of mistakes. Or even the child that has difficulty organizing themselves before they leave home or preparing for school, and they often lose their clothing items or their school items or their toys. So those are some examples. Other examples to look out for are children that are always on the go. Even if you're sitting at the dinner table, their hands are moving, their legs are shaking, they have difficulty sitting, or they talk a lot, way more than normal. And even sometimes just to strangers, they can go up, start up a conversation and speak a lot. Or even if they have difficulty, like just sitting and relaxing or playing very quietly. And if you're having a conversation with the child or in a social situation, these children often shout out or they speak or interact with other people they're very impatient, they struggle taking chances of it, and they also, you can see a wide range of emotions. They have struggle controlling their sadness or their anger, and they're very prone to meltdowns or outbursts. And even when we're looking at their sleep patterns, they're very erratic. They either sleep way too much or too little, and this obviously affects a lot of other parts of their daily life. And with all of this, we notice that there's a lot of lower self-esteem, and their feelings of anxiousness, and they feel very alone because they talk differently to other people. Sometimes they behave very differently, and what other people find very simple. So if you have like a neighbor or a cousin, and you notice that they are doing certain things, but your kid still struggles to get ready in the morning, still struggles to do their homework, still struggles to follow instructions, those are some telltale signs that they might need more investigation. So it's important that we acknowledge also their feelings of like low self-esteem and anxiousness so that we can support the child.
From your perspective, I think an important thing to discuss is you know, how long, because there's often a question you get asked, how long is my child going to be on medication for? I'm sure you get that quite a lot, and often so do we. Perhaps we can just talk a little to that in the sort of, you know, as we start winding down, about, you, of course, you mentioned the very well-known one. Of course, there are others, many others on the market these days. And I really want to also just perhaps get your opinion on some of the, whether it's homeopathic or non-allopathic medication that is often, even those, you know, the anti-Ritalin campaigners will say, you know, whether it's there are many of them, your opinion on the use of these alternative products and whether you think it's something to be recommended or avoided.
I think first and foremost, what you call, once the medication, you get a response, and obviously that reflects all the value of it is shown in the child's academic performance. And can quite often it's the teachers who pick up where the child, let's say, may have on a particular day forgotten to take the medication, and the teacher will say, you haven't taken the medication today because you are not on task. That's the first thing. The other is that this is, first and foremost, belief was that children outgrow this problem. And the answer is no, unfortunately, no. What happened is that if the cause is, let's say, brain immaturity, then with growth and development, you are going to get some changes, especially like the hyperactivity part starts settling down. But the impulsivity and the intention remains. So these kids, you actually continue into adolescence and even now into university, because there's a learning environment that's required. And therefore, medication is still used into young adulthood. And there have been a number of adults who are now coming to the fore, and we are diagnosing adults with ADHD. Now, some of these have actually fallen in the crack, where during childhood and early adolescence, they were not recognized, did not, what you call, get any treatment, and they just merely, because they were smart enough, they scraped through. They sort of received their 60s and 70%, when in fact they should have had AIDS. So, therefore, we recommend continuing into adulthood as well. If those, and you weigh the pros and cons of continuing medication in that period. The problem often is that during adolescence and young adulthood, other conditions start coming to the fore. One of them, unfortunately, is substance abuse, that these individuals, in their impulsivity, experiment with many drugs, etc., and the consequences and complications of those abuse of substances we have to deal with. Then there is a connection between attention deficit disorder and bipolar disorder, that some of these young people end up with bipolar disorder, mood disturbance, which requires treatment in its own right. Therefore, I think regular assessments and follow-up and review of treatment, it's not that you're condemning somebody to lifelong treatment, but it's assessing the child and young adult and saying, "What these are the benefits for you, because the crucial part is your academic functioning, your occupational functioning, your social functioning. So those consequences can be quite severe for the person. And unfortunately, when you look at these young adults into marriage, it becomes much more difficult for the spouse to deal with their inattention and impulsivity.
About the alternative products.
The point on the alternative products. Unfortunately, by the time they come to us, many of these children have been, or parents have been to the pharmacies, especially the large group of pharmacies, where there's whole stacks of all of these medications. The unfortunate reality is that many of these are so-called natural, but when I point out to the parents that have you looked at the side of the box and looked at all the substances that are there, one of my colleagues actually had done this experiment where going into this huge pharmacy and picking up about 30 of these homeopathic medications and looking at their, not benefits, but the side effects of the, what were the contents, the ingredients. It was quite shocking what are some of the potential side effects of these medications. And therefore, to me, they have got no role whatsoever in the management. What it may be doing is providing the structure which means these children need, the predictability, the scheduling that is what Fatima talked about as well, is getting them on task and making this kind of taking the medication regularly, maybe that may be the benefit. But unfortunately, there's very limited benefit for some of the, I don't want to mention the allopathic or the homeopathic medications that are there on the market. But I don't find them singularly not useful at all. It's quite often when parents have failed with all of that, that they come to us and saying, and that's usually late, you know, into sort of young adulthood or adolescence.
And in terms of the newer drugs, of course you mentioned Ritalin, but of course there are the others. Side effect profiles have always been a concern. You know, what is the side effect profile, for example, or the concerns that people have with the newer medication, and how does that fit in terms of tolerability, adherence, etc.?
Well, you know, you say newer, it's not new in terms of the ingredient. It's methylphenidate, What we had previously was a short-acting preparation, which worked for about 4 hours. That's what I often start off with, because it just gives you an idea of whether this child is going to respond or not. Then we have sort of the formulation changing so that it becomes long-acting, and the dosing becomes once a day. So it's given once in the morning and works for about 8 to 10 hours. So the way the methylphenidate is packaged and then absorbed into the bloodstream is different for some of these preparations. But by and large, they are, let's call it, identical in terms of what the substance is. The active ingredient is methylphenidate for those. As far as the side effects are concerned, they are common side effects, and they are rare ones. And unfortunately, people focus on the rare one. The common side effects, I mean, is one is the appetite goes away. And therefore, the advice would be that the child should have a good breakfast and such an evening meal. If the medication is worn out, you know, by 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, then a good meal then, and then also an evening meal to minimize the loss of weight. Because with the loss of appetite, the weight is lost. Then a bigger challenge is the sleep disturbance. But because this medication has an alerting part, in terms of focusing, these children have difficulty falling off to sleep. And they could be awake till 10, 11 at night and still difficulty settling down. And that is a challenge in management. You try and sort of you avoid, because these kids do not tolerate, and in fact it's contraindicated, giving them any sleeping medication. So we try and sort of work out a routine around bedtime for these children so that they can settle in the evening without too much difficulty, but that's some side effect that has to be dealt with. Then you get sort of some kids which you call, become as parents describe as numb or zombies, where they become too quiet. And the parents are so used to having this active child, and they often complain that, you know, my child has lost his personality. And we say, no, it's part of the medication. And if it is so severe, then obviously one has to stop the medication. Anxiety and depression is fairly common as well. Some of these children actually end up crying quite excessively. And then really, fortunately, because these medications are related to sort of dopamine production, and we know that excess dopamine is involved in psychotic-like behavior, so they could have hallucinations and delusions. Like I said, fortunately, it's rare, and therefore, one still has to be aware of it and stop the medication and go for the alternative medications that have been used for these conditions.
Alhamdulillah, thank you so much. We've almost come to end of our time. Fatima, are there any concluding remarks from your side?
I think that the best type of treatment strategy for children with ADHD are the multimodal ones that that Dr. Miller spoke about. So it requires a lot. Sometimes it takes time to figure out the right treatment, the right dosages. Managing it takes a lot of time and persistence. So my advice would be, as a parent, you do know what is best for your child. So visit the relevant healthcare professionals, ask questions, and don't stop until you completely understand what your child needs, what treatments they've been given, so that you know the best way to support your child at home and to figure out a way that works best for you as a family as well. So, yeah, that's just my last and concluding remark.
Well, thank you so much. Ismail, anything that you want to stress before we close?
I think a child like this in a family can be quite challenging, and therefore our approach has to be sort of towards the family. And that leads us as clinicians to work in a coordinated manner rather than in our own silos, doing our own thing and not communicating with it. And I'm sure as a general practitioner, you see this where the fragmented care that's provided and clinicians involved in the management are not talking to each other and do not do what's supposed to be done that requires their skills. So my plea is for, you know, much more multidisciplinary working together for the management of this child and family.
Absolutely, and I think this is something parents must keep in mind. It's not an easy condition. It needs, unfortunately, it's not something that's going to be solved with a tablet or a tablet only. We see this in practice, how difficult it is on the patient and, of course, on the family. A reminder, if I may, that the Islamic Medical Association this weekend is hosting some training courses on CPR, choking, etc., in various masajid in Johannesburg, in the Durban area. The details you can get from the IMA offices, which if you look up the website, you'll get all of the details. So please avail yourself, and if there are people who want to volunteer to train, the training is happening on Saturday, and a lot of the courses on Sunday is part of the International Lifesavers Day. This will be taking place in various masajids, so it'll be wonderful to have everybody attend. From our perspective, alhamdulillah, we've got a whole new bunch of presenters who've come on board, had some training, and I think, inshallah, from October, you will start to hear many new presenters take on the IMA Medical World programs. So it gives us, we've been doing it for a while, a bit of a break, but it's great to have young, dynamic, many allied healthcare professionals we're very happy to say have come on board to start presenting the show. If you have been listening to Medical File brought to you by the Islamic Medical Association, a special thanks to our guest, specialist psychiatrist Ismail Mullah, and occupational therapist Fatima Randri. Jazakallah so much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.